actually rather fond of Sir Colin Campbell, even though he was prone to tell them where to die and where not to die, replied, took up a chorus, "Aye, Sir Colin, if needs be, that's what we'll do." And the rest, as they say, is history. But where does the thin green line come in? Well, in a sense, the plant world is a thin green line, somewhere between the planetary rock and the atmosphere, which is essential to the functioning of our planet and for our survival. Yet it is under a tremendous assault, an assault more deadly and rapacious and sustained than the Russian heavy brigade. And it's going on day after day after day. And we need, I think, to be very careful that we don't find ourselves in a position where irreparable damage is done. Well, to illustrate the thin green line, this is not to scale because we have 6,000 kilometers of the radius of the Earth, and then just 30 kilometers of atmosphere. So really this blue bit is far too big. It should be just the almost invisible streak of blue, which indicates really how vulnerable the atmosphere is, how small the atmosphere is relative to the size of the Earth. But this little streak is just 100 meters at most. The tallest trees are 100 meters high, and green life extends about 100 meters down into the oceans. That's all it is, a green smear of 100 meters. Now, this is really significant on many levels. Firstly, because that thin green line, that 100 meters of green, is responsible for our planet being habitable. And here are our sister planets. This is Venus, this is Mars. And of the three, I know where I'd rather live, because Venus is incredibly hot. If you went out for a stroll on the surface of Venus, your body would instantly melt and would self-combust, and you would flare up in a brief sort of sputter of flame, and then all that would be left of you would be a little bit of mineral ash, mainly calcium phosphate, and that would be it. So not a place I would recommend taking a stroll. Mars too, these are the average surface temperatures. And the Earth's average surface temperature is about Vancouver temperature, very, very pleasant. And long may it remain so. Now, how did these planets get to be so different in temperature? Well, partly, of course, it's explained by the different distance they are from the sun. But that does not explain all of the temperature differences. So what does? Well, here is a simple diagrammatic representation of how these planets got to be the temperatures they are. Now, in Venus, we see that the water vapor, a hot planet, all the water vaporized into the atmosphere, and this caused the greenhouse effect. And the greenhouse effect caused greater warming, which in turn caused the CO2 to be degassed out of the rocks, and that caused more greenhouse. And so you got a runaway greenhouse effect. And that runaway greenhouse effect only came to rest when the average surface temperature of the planet was 480 degrees centigrade. And the atmosphere on Venus is thick, treacle thick. And so any radiation coming into the Venusian atmosphere stays there. And that is why it is so hot, because of this runaway greenhouse. Mars, on the other hand, has a runaway refrigerator effect. Because being a cooler planet, the water vapor liquidized, the CO2 at those temperatures stably combines with rock, the temperature drops, and so on. The air on Mars is incredibly thin, wispy thin. In fact, the atmospheric pressure is only a tenth of what it is on Earth. And under those conditions, solar radiation is not trapped within the atmosphere of Mars, and the runaway refrigerator cools it. Now, what's different about the Earth? Well, what is different about the Earth is that there is a greenhouse effect, but the CO2, when it's outgassed, is then sequestered again by what? By plants. And so life creates a balance. It short circuits the greenhouse effect, and by constantly fixing carbon, it maintains a relatively equitable temperature on this planet. And it's also got a very strong feedback loop. It's very stable, because when the temperature starts to drop, because there's not enough carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which happens periodically, then plants start dying. So carbon dioxide is not fixed, and a greenhouse effect then starts and takes over and warms. Now, the real question is, what are the bounds of stability of that system? Because if we pushed it over the limits of stability, whatever they are, then we might end up with a runaway greenhouse and end up with a temperature approaching that of Venus, which wouldn't be such a pleasant place to live. Of course, another interesting point is that Mars, which isn't too bad a climate, there are many places on Earth where you'd experience temperatures of minus 60. Mars could possibly be given a thicker atmosphere and could be warmed to make it habitable by humans. It might take thousands of years, but this terraforming of Mars, which could only be achieved in the long term anyway, by seeding Mars by plants, is certainly possible. And I think it demands very serious attention as to whether this might be one very important solution to the very long-term future of humanity. How would one go about terraforming Mars? Well, probably you'd use this thing. Chroococcidiopsis is probably the most resistant and remarkable plant on Earth. It can tolerate extremely high temperatures and extremely low temperatures. In fact, anywhere where there are no plants at all, if you turn over a stone, particularly a translucent quartz pebble, say in the Gobi Desert, you will likely find a little green smear, which likely as not will be this Chroococcidiopsis. And now, at present, of course, Mars has very high ultraviolet light levels. And this is a major problem. But one way to get algae like this to grow on Mars would be to put lenses of glass on the surface of Mars and put the algae underneath these so that the glass would protect them from the radiation. So I would be very, very surprised if within the next few hundred years some attempt isn't made to terraform Mars. And I would be very surprised if in the next 1,000 years or so there weren't people living on Mars. But I hope very much that we don't live on Mars because it is no longer possible to live on Earth. That would be a very sad and tragic thing. Now, there's another green alga that I'd like you to make your acquaintance, and that is Prochlorococcus. Like the previous alga, this is a bacterium, a green bacterium. And there are colossal numbers of these in the ocean. Down to a depth of about 200 meters, there are about 100,000 of these in every milliliter of water. This is absolutely colossal. This is the green skin. This is the thin green line of the ocean. But what I find absolutely staggering and also almost culpable is that this was not discovered until 1988. So something that is vital to the functioning of the planet, we didn't know about until 1988. It begs the question, rather, what else do we not know about the functioning of this planet and how it does its carbon exchange? Well, if Mother Nature sent us a bill, it would probably be something like this. Please pay natural ecosystems the sum of $33 trillion for services provided January 2002 to January 2003. Note, payment for years 10,000 BC to present is overdue. Credit will not be extended indefinitely. Now, where does this figure of $33 trillion come from? Well, it's very difficult to calculate these numbers. But that's a figure that was calculated by a team, quite a reputable team, and published in the journal Nature. Other teams have come up with slightly different figures, but they're all in the trillions of dollars. Now, what is this sum? Well, if there were no natural ecosystems, we would not have shelter from trees, for instance. The watersheds would not be protected. So the water would run off and erode the soil. In fact, we would have to spend billions of dollars making good what's being provided for free. Now, the fact is, we're not being sent the bill. This is for free. So we need to be very, very careful that we don't destroy it, because if we do, we do have to pay. So let me demonstrate what I mean by these ecosystem services. And of course, not all the ecosystem services are provided by plants. Some ecosystem services, very important ones, provided by soil bacteria. But soil microorganisms and plants provide most of the ecosystem services. They include things like watershed protection, nitrogen fixation, recycling of toxic waste, shelter, medicines. The list goes, you can think of about 100 different things. Here's an example from the water supply. So we can think of this as the Greater Vancouver water supply. Here we have the Strait of Georgia. The coast mountains, and here's Vancouver. And what happens? Well, we get evaporation over the Pacific and precipitation over the mountains. Now, if there were no plants, that water would run off and be lost. And it would also cause erosion. But the watersheds are protected by forest. Or they certainly should be. And the water then goes gradually into bulk storage reservoirs, which is then supplied to people. And of course, it is then used for sewage treatment. And plants have a big role to play here. Many sewage treatment systems involve plants. Water recycling systems may involve plants as well. Algae or higher plants like reed. And waterway protection, bank stabilization is all done by plants. Of course, if there were no plants growing on the banks of your rivers, the banks of the rivers would collapse and they would have to be shored up, dredged. People would have to spend money. Now, how much money? Well, the city of New York spends, unbelievably, $9 billion in around the vicinity of upstate New York and neighboring states on watershed protection, paying people to manage watersheds and make sure there is plants on them and not agriculture on them. And it's prepared to spend that money because the water treatment that it would have to do would cost more if the watersheds were not properly protected. So if the watersheds are not protected, you have to spend a lot of money. So you never, ever log in a watershed area near to a city. So I hope nobody would ever do that in Vancouver. Well, we hope. What are their ecosystem services? Well, I'll just point out a few. Drop the lights a bit lower. We need nitrogenous fertilizer to make plants grow. This is because plants contain protein, which of course all animal life needs plant protein for food. So it's nitrogen is one of the main constituents of protein. So somehow the nitrogen has to get onto the soil. And this is one way of doing it. This is the Pak Arab fertilizer factory outside Islamabad in Pakistan. You probably won't find it in your guidebook to Pakistan, but here it is, producing fertilizer. Somehow, to produce nitrogenous fertilizer, you have to get the nitrogen from the air. Now, there's plenty of nitrogen in the air, but it's in a very unreactive form, so it's very difficult. Now, one can do it this way by using a lot of fossil fuel and catalyst to force nitrogen to be hydrogenated and form ammonium. Or you can be a plant and do it. And leguminous plants have these nodules on their roots. And they do it without any heat at all. They do it with no petroleum. They do it just by using the sunlight that falls on the leaves of the plants, which makes ATP, which is the energy source of all living organisms. And that ATP, by an almost miraculous and exceedingly complex series of biochemical steps, makes atmospheric nitrogen, pulls atmospheric nitrogen, this almost incredibly unreactive gas, and makes ammonium, reduces it. And what is exciting, or what excites me, is in the last year, incredible strides have been made in understanding how nitrogen fixation is done, thanks to the science of genomics. What has been a mystery, how plants achieve so effortlessly what is so difficult for man to do, is probably in the next year or two going to be elucidated. It's a very exciting time for this field. You'll notice that these legume nodules are pink. And if you dig up a pea plant in your garden and break open the little nodules on the roots that fix this nitrogen, you'll find that they are pink as well. And they're pink for a very good reason. And that reason is exactly the same reason that your blood is pink, because it contains hemoglobin, exactly as your blood contains hemoglobin. And it contains hemoglobin because it needs to mop up all the oxygen out of these cells, because to hydrogenate nitrogen and make ammonium by combining nitrogen with hydrogen ions, that is a very reducing reaction, needs very reducing conditions in chemistry speak. So any oxygen would kill the reaction stone dead. And that is why these plants have hemoglobin. Legumes are responsible for fixing a huge amount of nitrogen every year. And if we didn't have them, we would have to pay these people much more money to make more nitrogenous fertilizer. And we would have to burn a lot more oil to do it. Now, another ecosystem service is the provision of medicines. And one example I'm going to give you is from the yew tree. Now, I come from Britain, and in Britain there are a lot of yew hedges. People like yew, and in fact, people have been clipping the same yew trees in some cases for 500 years. And here is Levens Hall in Cumbria, which has some very famous topiary, some of which has been continuously clipped for several hundred years. And nowadays, the clippings of those yews are gathered up and sent to Aventis Pharma, which used to be known as Rhône Poulenc. It's a big pharmaceutical company, and made into a precursor of a very important breast cancer drug called Taxotere. Some people will have taken a very similar drug called Timofen, I think it is. Timoxifen. Timoxifen, thank you. So, but Taxotere is often taken in combination with Timoxifen. And these yew clippings in England are sold for about 50 cents a kilo, converting from the pounds. And it's a wonderful system, because if you clip your yew every year, you have to dispose of the yew clippings. And to be able to get a drug company to come and take them away is a very good thing. And the Oxford Botanical Garden sells all their yew clippings to Aventis. And it is particularly poignant for the Oxford Botanical Garden, because I know the curator very well, and his partner was diagnosed with breast cancer and was successfully treated with this very drug. So I once asked her, well, people are like to think about the cost of ecosystem services. Well, you're someone who's benefited from this plant-derived drug. It's in fact, what it is it's too expensive to synthesize the entire drug. So they get a precursor from the yew clippings and then complete the synthesis from that. And it takes away the most expensive and difficult step. But I asked her, if we were to turn this into money, which, this invoice from nature, the $33 trillion, if this drug hadn't been available and the worst had happened, how much would, what would be reasonable as a necessary compensation for you and other people who'd been similarly affected? So can we put a figure on the invoice from nature that we would get from this? And her response was very clear. She said, that's a completely potty way to think. Of course it is. But I think we need to make the point that plants give us something for free, and at our peril do we not realize that. And there's also something completely intangible. I like this quotation from Charles Darwin, Voyage of the Beagle. "The traveler," he said, "should be a botanist, for in all views, plants form the chief embellishment." How true. And he then went on to liken it to, if you go to a concert, then if you understand something about music and have trained yourself to appreciate notes and different instruments, well, how much more do you enjoy the concert? So if you're a traveler looking at views, then you ought to know something about plants, the greater to enjoy all these wonderful views. And this is one of my favorite plants. This is tilopia, in the Proteaceae from Australia. And tilopia means, in Greek, seen from afar, because it is indeed seen from, when it was discovered Captain Cook's voyage, they saw it right up in the distance and knew that there was something interesting. And there is a message here, because it's meant to be seen from afar. It has been selected to be seen from afar because it relies on pollinators, which it needs to attract to pollinate it. So if we think about it, our color vision that makes us enjoy plants and enjoy art and so many things, that came about because plants put color into the world. Before flowering plants, the earth was rather dull. Everything was was a different shade of green or brown. And animals generally had very poor color vision. But insects and birds gradually started to respond to the secondary chemistry of the new flowering plants, which created pigments. And as acuity of vision, color vision improved, so the colors of plants got brighter as their secondary chemistry was selected for. And gradually, the world was colored almost by an invisible brush. And without the secondary chemistry of plants producing the colors of flowers and fruits, we would not have color vision because there would be no evolutionary reason for us to have color vision. So we have plants to thank for our colored world. Now, this is all very well. We've established, I think, that plants are interesting and important, and indeed our whole planet depends upon the fixation of carbon they do. But they are also very fragile. I'm going to illustrate this by some material from the island of St. Helena in the South Atlantic Ocean, which I've studied. And this is from an old Portuguese sketch of the harbor at St. Helena. Here is the Malacca fleet in, and the Portuguese used St. Helena as a stopping off point from the Far East for returning galleons. And in fact, they thought it was a gift from Providence. When they discovered it, they thought that it was a gift of Providence to aid their East India trade. But unfortunately, Providence had not seen fit to put goats on the island. But that was something the Portuguese very quickly remedied, this oversight of Providence. And you can see a goat prancing up on the mountaintop, and two little men with muskets going, trying to get the goats. So the goat was introduced in about 1511. And by 1560, when Cavendish discovered the island, it was the first English navigator to discover the island, he noted that there were flocks of goats on St. Helena up to a mile long. Now, that's an awful lot of goats, particularly when the island is only 10 miles long. And the result is this. Those slopes used to be covered with forest, but the goats prevented any regeneration of the trees. So the trees died, and the rains came, and the unprotected soils on these steep slopes simply washed into the sea. And early navigators recorded in their logs that after tropical storms, they noted that the sea around St. Helena was black. Now, it takes a lot of soil to make a sea black. Now, this, if nothing else is, this is an example of suddenly getting the bill from nature. And two-thirds of the island now is completely barren. And the present-day government of St. Helena has been spending a lot of money, millions of pounds, on trying to rehabilitate this land. And almost every rehabilitation attempt has so far failed. Now, I was particularly interested because those slopes, one of the dominant plants on those slopes was the St. Helena ebony. And this was believed to have become extinct in 1860. And here is an old bit of wood of it that had been found in a gully. But I thought, well, maybe, just maybe, it survived somewhere. But it would only survive where no goats would be able to get to it. So I went to the steepest, biggest, most dangerous, horrible cliff that I could find. And there's one of my colleagues, George Benjamin, and that's his brother, Charlie Benjamin, climbing. There's a rope between them. And the plant, the St. Helena ebony, the last existing St. Helena ebony in the world, is there. And very nice it was to see. That's the first flower of the St. Helena ebony that any human eyes had ever seen for 120 years. And so naturally we wanted to set about trying to conserve this. And at first there was no money and very few facilities. So the ebony plants here had to be grown from cuttings in these blue margarine tubs. Margarine is imported to St. Helena in big blue tubs, and that's what these are. But it proved actually quite easy to propagate. But getting it back onto those eroded slopes is very difficult because there's no soil there. But there are a few small successes in trying to remediate some of these places. But it may take hundreds of years. So I want to go on and talk about another aspect of fragility, and that is continental forest, and particularly tropical forest. The tropical forest, the large unbroken wilderness areas of forest, of tropical forest, are these here along the equatorial regions. And they have been massively fragmented, as we can see in this map here. Now, this is very sad because most of the Earth's biodiversity, most of the plant life on Earth, exists within those forests. And, well, this is me, and here am I in one of these forests here. In fact, this is in an island between Borneo and the Philippines. And it's very, very hot, but we're collecting tropical gingers in the forest. And it's very, very hot. Even the porters look a little bit worn out in that picture. But in that spot, in that locality, we collected several new species of plant, and these are now described. And I'm quite convinced there are several more undescribed species still to be discovered on that island. So the richness and what is still to be discovered is really quite remarkable that we know so little about our own planet. We spend millions, even billions, on missions to space and mapping the cosmos. The Hubble Space Telescope, when it was first launched, cost about $60 million US dollars. The cost since then has risen by many hundreds of millions. That amount of money would pay for a complete inventory of Earth's biodiversity, but it isn't available. So map the cosmos we can, but do a mission to our own planet. There is no political will. You're very curious. Now, this is a scene of deforestation, and tropical forest is disappearing extremely fast. Over the last few years, I have been greatly saddened by what I've seen at first hand. In the year 2000, I went to Sumatra to collect plants, and it was at a time of the year was very dry, and tropical rainforest in drought times will burn. And people were setting fires all over Sumatra because a massive land grab was underway. The Suharto regime in Indonesia had fallen. There was very little control over state forest lands, and people were burning, moving into the forest, claiming it, and growing crops, even though it was gazetted government land. They felt, and we talked to some people we met, they felt that if the government ever came and said that was their land, they would just say, no, they'd always been there, and there was a mistake. And of course, they're quite right. It will never go back to forest. Now, what happens when the forest goes, the heat and intensity of solar radiation is so great, and the rainfall is so great, that with the forest not there, this land just erodes. All the organic matter is oxidized almost immediately by the heat, and the erosion starts making gullies and erodes right down to mineral soil. Nothing will grow on these areas except tropical weeds, very resistant tropical weeds. And the heat is intense. You walk through these areas and the sun is glowering down, it's 40 degrees, and you reach this, the forest margin, and you step into the forest, as I did, and bliss. The temperature drops to a cool 30 degrees, and it is the most wonderful feeling. 30 degrees! That is so cool compared to the inferno outside, and really quite pleasant to walk in and work in. And another thing I noticed about moving from these cleared areas into the forest when I was in Sumatra in 2000 was the incredible difference in the sound. Because out here, there is silence, complete silence. And you step into the forest, and suddenly there's a cacophony. The birds, the crickets, cicadas. The cicadas are going like lawnmowers, and you hear monkeys, gibbons in the background, screeching and howling. And then you step out, silence. And it's uncanny. You step in, this cacophony. And it's life and death. It's like going from a dead zone to a living zone. And to see that forest edge going back and back and back is one of the most heartbreaking things that I have ever seen. And back it is going. And why? Well, there is a land hunger. And eventually, all this land gets converted into agricultural land. In Brazil, it's likely to be soybean. In Malaysia, it will be oil palm or small holdings, people growing maize, whatever. But it will never be rainforest again. It will not have those cicadas and the birds and the gibbons. That will be gone. And it's because of this land hunger. And if we look at the figures, just do the back of the envelope calculations, the current UNEP projection for world population is that it will double before stabilizing. It will double from the 6 billion we are now to 11 or 12 billion before stabilizing. Now, if that is right, and I desperately hope it is, but it's as we're dealing with an exponential process, it's very difficult to be, it's very easy to be 10 billion or so out, if that's true, then we're dealing with a doubling of population, and most of the doubling will occur in these tropical rainforest areas, or a lot of the doubling will. And that will require a doubling of food production. There is enough food in the world now to feed everybody in the world. But as the population doubles, to have the same amount of food security, we will need to double the production. Now that means either we double the production on a given amount of land, or we double the amount of land under cultivation. And at the moment, the land approach is working well. And a lot of Brazil is disappearing under soya. But if we want to talk about sustainable agriculture, what does sustainable agriculture mean? Well, the touchstone of sustainability has to be biodiversity. Because that is the really, truly non-renewable resource. I once spoke to an economist who said, plants don't matter because they're a renewable resource. They just make more of themselves. What matters, we should be desperately concerned about the depletion of tin reserves. I said, tin? For goodness sakes! Plants are renewable only if we have some of them to renew the rest. But if a plant that is made extinct is not renewable, it is far more complex and valuable than tin. And to be sustainable, we must sustain the rest of life on Earth, because that is what sustains us. So how are we going to do that? How are we going to preserve the wild tomatoes here, as well as preserving the land races, as well as having space to grow the cultivated land races of tomato? Well, that is a very, very difficult and important question. Well, I'm now going to talk about a bit about politics, because one response that has been made to agriculture is organic growing. And everybody likes organic food, but I have a slight problem with organic food, and that is because I do not see that it can be a global solution. The organic movement started with this lady, Lady Eve Balfour, in the 1930s, who wanted to develop a system of low-input farming. Well, low-input farming is very good, but the organic movement got wrapped up in quite a bit of baggage. Lady Eve Balfour was very influenced by the biodynamic farming movement, which held that cycles of fertility were needed to renew the soil, and there were various things like a cow's horn had to be held to the fertilizer to imbue it with the spirit of that, and so on and so forth. Very, very strange. But a little bit of that came into organic farming. Now, low input is good because it's sustainable, but low input without high productivity is not globally sustainable, because we cannot double food production by keeping agricultural land holdings the same using organic systems. And it's a pity, but I've looked into this very carefully. The best possible organic growing, and this experiment used the best possible practices and was done by the same farmer on the same farm, very carefully controlled. But the best organic farming could do was to produce yields about two-thirds of that of conventional farming. Wonderful produce, wonderful low-input farming, but with double the people in the world, this will never, sadly, be more than a superb luxury for the bourgeoisie of Europe and North America. And it's a wonderful luxury. I mean, I like it myself, and I would defend to the death the right of anybody to pay more for their vegetables if they so wanted. The emperor, indeed, has no clothes. Another problem with organic farming is that yield is exceedingly insecure. Potato blight, for instance. Potato blight can cause incredible damage, can wipe out crops, and I've seen this in Indonesia, small peasant holdings of potatoes, the crop completely destroyed by potato blight, and so the organic farming movement made an exception. Made a few exceptions to its pesticides, no pesticides rule, and the Soil Association allowed copper sulfate, particularly for the control of potato blight and a few other fungal diseases. Now, copper sulfate used to be known as Bordeaux mixture because it was used extensively to control mildew on vines. But it is exceedingly toxic. Exceedingly toxic, but it is. I think it's approved. I don't know why it's approved by organic farming. I think it's because it sounds old-fashioned, because it's just copper sulfate. You know, it's just something we all remember from our chemistry books. Whereas something like mancozeb sounds horrid. It sounds as if a corporation made it. It sounds as if it must be bad. But if you look at the If you look at the toxicity, mancozeb is no more toxic than sodium chloride, common table salt. And it is it's inactivated. It has a decay time in the soil of 6 to 15 days, and it has low ecotoxicity, and it's not a harmful chemical. And if you asked me to take a pinch of copper sulfate or mancozeb, I would quite happily take a pinch of mancozeb and eat it. No wild horses would not convince me to ingest copper sulfate. But one is approved by organic farming and the other is not. Well, this isn't science, it's politics. Low input farming is very good, but we must not allow politics to cloud judgment. And another thing that could be a wonderful solution to low input farming and really make the organic movement take off is to use genetically modified crops. But this is something that the organic movement again has set itself against, even though genetic modification has never had any proven health hazard whatsoever. And it's been eaten by almost all North Americans in their diet daily for over 5 years. And it's produced no ill effects at all. So this is something far less toxic. This is a solution far less toxic than that. But organic farming has completely set itself against what might be an extremely important way of achieving low input farming and creating huge environmental benefits. And another thing that I find slightly odd about organic farming is that it's just a wee bit of a scam. And nothing illustrates it better than organic cigarettes. In fact, when I heard about organic cigarettes, it took me about half an hour to deconstruct this extraordinary concept. Because organic things are supposed to be healthier because they're natural. Well, so presumably that means you get more nicotine and more tar from organic cigarettes, so they'll kill you a little bit faster. In fact, the reason why tobacco is so toxic is that it grows in South America where there are lots of herbivorous rodents, and it has evolved a chemical which is selected to kill mammals. It's one of the most toxic chemicals to kill mammals known. And the reason why people smoke it is because it is so toxic that the nicotine in a single cigarette would kill you unless you burnt it. And 90% of the nicotine will burn off, and you will get just a tiny little dose of a chemical that is not only very toxic, it's more addictive than heroin. And but here we have organic tobacco, which presumably is, by being natural, presumably has more and better toxin. And I feel so sorry for those among us who still smoke, and there may be some in this audience, because not only do you get dinged by the federal government in a huge swinging tax, you have to fund all those jollies, but you also get dinged probably by the provincial government too, and then you get dinged by guilt that you should spend a little bit extra by buying organic tobacco. So anyway, that's just a little bit of fun. So, any other responses? Now, low input agriculture, sustainable agriculture, food security, and doubling yields so we don't lose most of the plants, the native natural plants on this planet, is really, really important. So important that it's not an appropriate response if someone says, I think there could be some environmental benefits in biotechnology. It is not appropriate to say, no, I'm sorry, I don't like biotechnology, so we won't discuss that. It's what is at stake is too important not to discuss all the options. Now, biotechnology, one important part of biotechnology is, of course, plant transformation. Now, plant transformation has been going on for millions of years. It is a completely natural process, which is done by this natural genetic engineer called Agrobacterium. And Agrobacterium is the crown gall. It's a very ingenious organism. It has its own DNA, and it has a little thing called a plasmid. And it uses this plasmid to insert a growth substance into plants to make them produce a nice little home for the bacterium, a gall. And this completely natural process, which nature has been using for millions of years, of course, the scientists get hold of it and start using it for non-natural means. So we need to think, are these means that the scientists are using it for good or bad? Potentially, it could be a route to low input agriculture, an agriculture that does not need pesticides, an agriculture that does not need high applications of fertilizer, an agriculture where yields are high and environmental damage is low. Potentially, it could improve the nutritional quality of food by increasing vitamin content and having a stab at eradicating a lot of nutritional disease. It could also help us move to a bio-based economy, when instead of getting our chemicals and raw materials from petroleum oil, and so doing, not have a hope in hell of meeting Canada's Kyoto obligations, move to some sort of carbon neutral industry. Well, I'll give you an example of how this could be used. This is castor bean growing in a garden. Many people will grow this in your garden. This is canola growing in Red River, Alberta. Much of the prairies looks like that. Now, castor bean produces castor oil. Now, castor oil is a ricinoleic oil, which is really quite good for a lot of industrial purposes. Canola produces an oleic oil, which is very similar, but it differs in a few structural things, which means that it's not good for industrial purposes, but it's extremely good for food purposes. And so it's used in margarines and for cooking oil. Now, this potential industrial oil, which could be used for not only as a carbon neutral petrol substitute, potentially it makes an extremely good biodegradable engine oil. Engine oil is quite a serious pollutant, particularly in because most marine traffic spews out engine oil because the engine is lubricated by oil, and that spews out into the sea. Chainsaws are constantly lubricated by engine oil, and this can cause a significant pollution in sensitive ecosystems. Making lubricant oil from castor bean is a potential solution to these problems. We can also make from this oil biodegradable polymers. So plastic bags could be fully biodegradable, like paper or anything else. So the environmental benefits are potentially huge. Unfortunately, castor oil, castor bean, is not easy to domesticate or harvest. It produces a low yield, and it produces it in such a way that it is very difficult to harvest. Put that ricinoleic oil into canola, and you have an easily harvestable, carbon-neutral industrial oil. Now, I mention this because the world leader of this research happens to be Canada. And this research is happening in British Columbia. In fact, it's being done by a company based at UBC, doing the work a couple of hundred meters from where we sit. And the potential environmental benefits of this sort of work are very great. We need to examine what it's about very carefully. We need more doctors for the planet. This caught my eye. Jonas Spring, who's an undergraduate at UBC, said that. And I thought, doctors for the planet. He was saying it because people give so much worth to medical doctors. Why not to people who would make the planet tick? Well, the problem is, I think, that in order to be a doctor for the planet, we need to be very careful that we're not producing quacks for the planet or snake oil salesmen, because snake oil salesmen could do a lot of damage here. In fact, a doctor for the planet would need a very thorough grounding in chemistry, geochemistry, organic chemistry, in physics, be able to calculate the physics of radiation balance. A doctor for the planet would need to be au fait with systems analysis and statistical methodology, ecosystem ecology, molecular biology, genomics, systematics, economic theory, social and political. It goes on and on and on and on. So this is a hard, hard thing. Now, many, many years ago, Oxford University decided to set up a degree course that would be so intellectually challenging that it would attract people from all over the world because of that intellectual challenge, and it would train future prime ministers. That degree course was called PPE, Philosophy, Politics, and Economics. And many of the prime ministers, British prime ministers of this century, read PPE at Oxford. And I just wonder whether we need to set up something so intellectually challenging in this area that future prime ministers of Canada will go through, be a doctor for the planet. Education, education, education. If the thin green line is going to survive, it must start here. And these are classes in UBC Botanical Garden with kids interacting with plants. I have a personal interest in this because when I was 6 years old, I was taken on a family trip to Kew Gardens in Britain. And when we went into one of the greenhouses, I saw, as my six-year-old, I could just learn to read, so I could read, there was a notice saying, please do not touch the plants. And it had never occurred to me to touch the plants. But the notice made it exceedingly attractive. So I rushed round the greenhouse, making up my mind to touch every single plant. And I found that such a fascinating thing that I ended up becoming a botanist. And I ended up standing here in front of you. So, education makes a difference. This is the UBC Food Garden, which you'll be pleased to know is entirely organic, run on the best organic principles. And this is a young man enjoying the fruits of the food garden. We must bequeath both the understanding to the next generation and a legacy which they can build on. And the thin green line, I think, may survive. Thank you very much.
Dr. Cronk is going to take questions, and I'm going to ask him to repeat the question before he answers it, if he would. Do you want to just field some questions?
Yes, sir. I got the feeling there is, but are they trying to take the gene for nitrogen fixation and put it in a whole bunch of other plants?
Ah, that's a very interesting question. The questioner asked, are they trying to take the gene for nitrogen fixation and put it in other plants? Well, indeed, that is the, would many people consider that a holy grail? Because if wheat was able to fix its own nitrogen, then there would be no need to fertilize wheat crops. We'd achieve low input agriculture, sustainable agriculture, and high yields of wheat. But it is very, very difficult because those nodules that fix nitrogen must be completely free of oxygen. And wheat, not needing to fix nitrogen, makes sure that oxygen fills every cell. So one, it's not just a matter of one gene, it would be hundreds. It's a monstrous task which won't be achieved for it's always dangerous saying won't be. I would say it won't be achieved for 100 years. There. You can hold me to it when someone does the breakthrough next year.
I just want to preface this with the fact that I'm very much in support of genetic research. However, I am concerned when you mentioned combining rinses with canola, what about genetic drift? Possibility of infecting perfectly good canola crops, organic or not, with the most toxic plant known on Earth.
The question is a very incisive, insightful question. The castor bean contains an enormously toxic protein called ricin. If one is to genetically engineer canola to produce castor oil, is there a chance that one may somehow make canola toxic? Well, of course, these things have to be very, very carefully regulated. But the genes that make ricin protein, which is so toxic, are completely different and in a completely different part of the genome from the single gene that's required to take the oleic acid in canola and make it ricinoleic acid. So there is no connection between the two. But regulation is the key, and people must be comfortable with the technology. But we're at a stage, I liken it to the early days of the railways. You know, when the steam engine was first invented, doctors came out and said, it may be impossible for the human body to survive traveling at 50 miles an hour. Because, of course, up to the time of the railway, the only people who traveled at 50 miles an hour had died, because the only way to achieve speeds of 50 miles an hour is to drop from a tall building. But with the invention of the railway, it suddenly became possible to travel at these speeds. And there was an enormous debate about whether people would die or survive, and what the health hazards would be. And in fact, in the early days of the railway, they had someone with a red flag walking in front of all the trains, so the trains couldn't go faster than walking pace. And fine, that's maybe what we need, a red flag at the moment. But of course, railways are far more dangerous than genetic modification ever will be. I bet a lot of money on that. Railways are extremely dangerous.
I still see genetic modification as being the
bogus. I really do. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'd like to come back to that. There's a question at the back. This is a question about...
That area is primarily mixed market gardens.
Right. Well, this is... The questioner asked, what is the effect of increased traffic on plant growth, in particular market gardening? Well, I would firstly say that this is out of my area, but never being one... balk at speaking on a subject he knows nothing about whatsoever, I would say that exhaust fumes are an extremely strong producer of nitric oxides, these will cause both fertilization, which is good, and strong acidification and pollution. Plant tissue death, which is bad. For that question, you need to ask someone who knows about traffic.
You had some slides when you discussed deforestation.
Mm-hmm. And kind of
before that.
Oh, yes. The before date was primeval. The whole of Europe, for instance, was green in that before one. The later one was 1997. It's quite a bit worse since then, because of the terrible fires in Indonesia. Yes, the questioner asked, can I say something more about the rehabilitation in St. Helena? I can. The main problem there is that because the soils have lost their vegetation cover, they're actively eroding, and the slopes are very steep. So every time there's a heavy rain, the soil just moves, it washes out. And active erosion is the worst possible thing. And it's very hard to stop. Erosion control on steep slopes is very difficult. There are various ways of digging gullies and trenches to try and stop. Cloudbursts on St. Helena are so fierce, if you don't have vegetation cover, I've seen big trenches which are to stop soil movement, just filling in just like that, and then the soil washing over. So the problem is erosion, and it's very hard to do anything about it. But by working on mainly on the shallower slopes, it's possible to get vegetation cover and slowly work onto the steeper slopes. It's a very difficult problem. All right,
during the past century, many cash can you foresee any kind of any change in this trend through genetic modified crops, etc.?
Right, the questioner asked or pointed out that cash crops have replaced food crops in many parts of the tropics. And this complicates food supply and food security. And do I see any trends for the future? Well, this is certainly true. Oil palm is a good example. Oil palm is fairly rampantly being planted widely in Southeast Asia. More an industrial crop than a food crop. The trend I see is that there'll be more of this because there is everyone has need of cash, and there's increasing need to move from an oil-based economy to a bio-based economy. And genetic modification will make this easier and will make and may have, like those canola plants, possibly producing castor oil. That's not food, that's an industrial crop. And this will put further demands. If we're to move, we have two problems. Not only do we have to grow twice as much food on the same amount of land, but we also have to use some of that land to get away from our dependence on oil. Because the only way to move from a dependence on mineral oil reserves, which we can no longer burn if we are to honor the Kyoto Agreement, is through growing plants. So it's very tricky. But food security must therefore be grown in smaller and smaller areas. And maybe that food may be needed to buy out farmers in other areas. I was very interested in China, for instance, that there is a rice surplus in China. The granaries are full, and they are using that rice to supply people in mountain areas near national parks to give them rice in order for them not to grow rice and not to go into and cultivate in national parks. So food, the politics of food and plant growth is going to get more complicated. Sorry, there was a question.
It's very likely we can't do a lot about the loss of rainforest in the central part of the world. But we have a similar problem in the boreal forest, northern forest of Canada. I'd like to comment a little bit on the drivers that are causing a drastic reduction in our boreal forest and maybe some suggestions about what we...
Yeah. The questioner asked about boreal forests as opposed to tropical forests. Now, from a global perspective, in biodiversity terms, the boreal forest, there's no ifs and buts about it. It is less important than the tropical forest. However, it is still a very significant wilderness area and very significant as a carbon sink for the planet. So. And also, if the countries of the rich north cannot set a good example, what moral authority do we have to lecture tropical countries on cutting down the forest? So, and the Europeans regularly get hit over the head with this one, because in Europe, there is no wilderness forest left. Europeans chopped it all down 10,000 years ago, or, well, no, not quite as long as that, 6,000 years ago. The Neolithic peoples went through Europe and went, and it all went into agriculture. Huge population explosion, it all went. And now Europe is about 4% forest. And the Europeans are very vocal about Brazil leaving all their nice forest. And the Brazilians say, oh, 4% would be a good amount. Well, why not? That's what Europe did. So it's a very difficult one. And Canada I think, has not only a moral duty to preserve its boreal forest, which is one of the glories of Canada, but also has a treaty obligation, because if that boreal forest goes, the carbon that is released has to be, you know, Canada is on a very, very tight carbon budget. I mean, I think the Kyoto Treaty is going to be broken anyway, but let's assume it's a realistic document. The boreal forest has to stay.
Two more questions.
Okay.
With regard to global warming and global cooling, without human intervention, do we know what the limits are through time as to what the lowest global average would have been and the upper?
No. Yes. The question is about global warming and global cooling through geological history on Earth. There have been very significant, very large fluctuations, which we now believe show how very sensitive the Earth's atmosphere, the Earth's climate, is to changes of carbon dioxide. And at times when we believe there has been a lot of the main producer of carbon dioxide in the past has been volcanic eruptions. And at certain times in the Earth's history, there's been an enormous amount of volcanism caused by changes in the distribution of plates, tectonic plates on the Earth. And at those times, there has been a lot of volcanic carbon dioxide, and as a result, temperatures enormously in excess of what we have now. Near tropical temperatures, even at polar regions. The other extreme is some people believe that in very remote geological time, temperatures on the Earth went so low that there might have actually been a snowball Earth with ice covering most of the Earth's surface. But always it is what is very remarkable is the ability of the system to right itself over millions of years through the action of plants. The only feedback mechanism that could get out of a snowball Earth or out of very hot climate is that thin green line. So there's enormous stability under natural conditions over millions of years. But what we don't know is whether when we're not now in under normal conditions, and if we are damaging our feedback mechanisms at the same time as introducing more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, well, nobody knows. Last question.
Kate, if you, disregarding all the biodiversity issues, and mm-hmm. which is going to be the greater carbon sink, an area covered with wheat or the same area covered with a temperate rainforest?
The rainforest is a... thank you. The question is an extremely important one. Which ecosystems are the best carbon sinks? And of course, they differ very greatly. A wheat field is a very, very poor carbon sink, because a lot of the carbon in an ecosystem is stored in the soil. And wheat fields have relatively poor carbon storage in the soil. And of course, the biomass of the wheat is rather small. Any forest ecosystem is a very, rather efficient carbon sink. And surprisingly, many people are surprised by this, a lot of it is because forest soils store huge amounts of carbon.
I'm going to ask Professor Ian Taylor, who's the former head of the Botany Department, to come and thank our speaker.
I don't think I need to tell this audience that the UBC Botanical Garden is a very worthwhile place to visit, and that as its research director, I'm always pleased to see people. I discovered something tonight that is an interesting connection. Professor Baird and I both, I think, know Levins Hall. She may well know it as a visitor and as a perhaps on the top of a double-decker bus where you could look over the wall of the Baggett family home, which is the Levins Hall, and see this wonderful topiary. My grandfather and my father grew up just a half a mile from Levins Hall, and I thought about the Green Line in a different way. The Green Line, the thin Green Line that I know at Levins Hall, or I knew, and I think my father knew as well, was the line behind the yew hedge behind which we hid when the gamekeeper came to chase my father, because he was very good at tickling trout, and me when I was trying unsuccessfully to poach rabbits at the end of World War II. So a different thought on the Green Line. I did tell Peter Nemetz that if he invited Quentin Cronk, he'd get enthusiasm, commitment, and an enormous collection of wonderful stories. I think, Peter, I was dead right. Thank you very much, Quentin.